Bono, the new album, Songs of Innocence, very kind of, you know, personal reflection stuff. You kind of rooted in autobiography. It's a very intimate album. Is it? Do you think it's your most intimate album yet, simply because of the subject matter?
In order to you know, to unlock ourselves, maybe just myself, and find some new, you know, material that anyone might be remotely interested in, I wanted to go to a place I'd never been before. And it turns out, asking the question, you know, why did you join a band in the first place? Yeah. You ran away with the circus. You know, why are you like this? You know, I decided rather than, you know, lie on a couch and talk to a shrink, I'd just go back into when I was a teenager, growing up on Cedarwood Road, as part of me still lives there, and then also just to listen to the music of the period, and that really did a lot of the work. Just playing the music of the late 70s just completely unlocked me as a songwriter.
Okay, that first track that we heard there was Cedarwood Road, and in particular, it's like a friendship thing, because you knew you had, if you like, what's the word for it, a kind of a kindred spirit with one or two people that you still hang around with there.
Well, I was dedicated to Googie.
Googie, yeah.
Yeah.
And you have a lovely tree in the garden, which you didn't have in yours, I take it.
Well, there was a moment when I brought in the lyric for Cedarwood Road, and Larry Mullen said to me, said, cherry blossom tree. We're going with cherry blossom tree.
Yeah, said, can we not
that's
make
brave.
That a bit
that's
more
brave.
Punk.
And yeah, the Rowans at number 5 Cedarwood Road had this cherry blossom tree, and I'd never seen anything as luxurious in my entire life. And you know, it's funny, I've since met somebody who reminded me that in Japan, the cherry tree is a big deal, and it covers, it's a strong spiritual symbol and covers the protection of innocence. But did I know that? No, I did not. But it was just a symbol of friendship. My friendship with Googie has lasted since I was 3 years old till now, and we're still the best of friends. And we helped each other get through our teenage years and on.
Okay, and like with all this stuff too, I'm going to get to talk about that too, which is other songs from the past, etc., in terms of everything to do with the 1970s. But just let's take a look at what you've done then over the last week or two. I mean, the actual kind of release of the album, it's not slow burn marketing. It never is with you two. It's always the big statement because you want as many people to hear as possible. There has been criticism over the last 10 days, quite a bit of criticism, just the way it was done.
Really?
Are you?
Wouldn't I have heard about this? Wouldn't people have complained online or something?
In fact, that's the funny thing, actually, that's very important about going online. 85% of people who go online to complain.
Look, the same people who used to write on toilet walls when we were kids are now in the blogosphere. The blogosphere is enough to put you off democracy. But no, let people have their say. Why not? But yeah, they're the haters, we're the lovers, we're never going to agree.
Okay, but like, you know, part of the DNA of you two, as you've said before, is to be heard by as many people as possible. So this deal that you did, make sure that you're heard by as many people as possible. As we speak, 10 days, 2 weeks later, it's downloaded already by, you know, 77 million, there's 500 million that can, etc. This was the thing for you, to get so many more people to hear the album.
That's it. You know, I got an email from Eve Hewson, who was in a taxi in a cab in New York. She got into a car, this Indian man was blasting out Songs of Innocence at the top, you know, top volume, and he turned it down when she got in the car. She says, you know, why would you turn it down? He said, I don't want to. And, you know, so people really who would not normally be exposed to our music have got a chance to listen to it. Whether they hold that to their heart or not, we don't know. Whether those songs will be important to them in a week's time or, you know, we don't know, but they've got a chance, and that's got to be exciting for a band that's been around as long as we have. The hardest thing in the world, as Bruce Springsteen said to me, and this is 10 years ago, is to surprise your audience or to surprise yourself.
But also to make a brand new audience at this stage of your career. And surely one of the things about this is half the people are saying, you two, never heard of them. You two, I think I've heard of them. I certainly wouldn't be able to mention any of their songs. Now they can, and they're there. And by the way, the result now is every second album is back in all album charts all over the world of your previous albums. And your singles album is, I think, in the top 10 of 14 different countries as we speak. That's a bit of a result of doing it this way, isn't it?
Yes. Look, it worked. And the only thing was this technological blip, which was some people, it didn't just stay in the cloud. It hopped into their phone. Apple are very sorry about that. They've sent people away to delete it. It's yeah. one click. I mean, really, come on. I was reminded of, and you will remember this, I was reminded of when Mrs. Edge, our first roadie, used to drive us in the VW Beetle in the middle of the night with rolls of wallpaper with the lyrics of our songs and various things. And we used to fly post all over Dublin, aged like 18 or 19. And it was just, that was the whole point in being in a band, especially at the time of punk rock, was to be in your face. Even if, you know, weren't looking for us, we were there. That was it. You remember the little badge? You had one, said you to anyone. So when everyone was being elitist and everyone was being too cool for school, you two were saying, we want to get out of town. We want to play these big venues. They said, no, we'll never leave the clubs. You know, the clubs, that's where all this bollocks. We knew it was bollocks then. We know it's bollocks now. This is a wonderful thing. Funnily enough, all the hip-hop people, everyone's like, wow, what a result. This is incredible. All the people who will own up to wanting an audience love it. And the only people who don't love it are people who, you know, feel we've gone too far. They can delete it. I can say to them, you know, no one has deleted more U2 songs in the last 5 years than the four members of U2. That is why it's taken so long.
Okay, well, let's go back to a song then. Let's go back to one of those times, because this is an album all about the 1970s to you, growing up, forming a band, and things that happened in terms of your personal life and things that happened outside. Let's go to one of the outside things of two songs in the album. One is about going to see the Ramones, and one is about the Clash. Let's be perfectly honest about two specific gigs. That gig in your notes of the Ramones, you didn't pay in, Bono.
No, there's another, yes, this is...
So if anybody listening right now wants to sneak into the next U2 gig?
We won't make it easy for you, but in no, those
well,
days,
the door had to be prized,
security was lax. You might have been working security. Were you at
no,
the show?
I was at the gig. I wasn't working security, and I didn't know you then. I think I got to know you about 6 months later.
Okay, so it was the State Cinema. It was
State
in Fibsborough.
Cinema in Fibsborough, yeah.
Four members of U2 arrive without tickets or the cash to pay for tickets, which is a bit mental, but... The hero of Cedarwood Road, Googie, actually has enough for his own ticket. He gets in and eventually finds an exit that just happens to be open. Does this sound familiar? And we break in and have our life turned upside down. And it's, you know, the Joey Ramone story just keeps going on, because we were in our rehearsal room and trying to get onto RTE. And we were fighting amongst ourselves on how to start a song, how to end a song, but somebody from RTE was coming around because they'd heard we wrote our own songs and we were like 17, 18 years old, 16, 17. And there's a knock at the door. The big shot has arrived. The big cheese has arrived. He walks in. He says, I believe you play your own songs. I would like to hear one. So we play him Glad to See You Go by the Ramones.
Glad to See You Go, 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 goodbye.
He says, did you write that? Yeah, we wrote that. And he says, well, you got a gig on, I can't remember where it was. And of course, when we got onto into the TV studio, we played one of our own songs and no one knew the difference. Yeah. I told a story to Joey Ramone. And he's like, that's really cool, man. You did that. That's so cool. And we told him about Dublin. We told him about, you know, our ambitions and all the rest. He said, you know, I've seen you guys in clubs. I've seen you in stadiums. He said, you know, the Ramones, we always wanted to play the big shows. He says, but we play big shows in Ireland and Brazil, he says. and he followed us, would turn up at all our shows. And so this kind of love affair went on. And then just sadly, when he passed away, his family got in touch to say that he'd listened to a U2 song called In a Little While. It was the last song he heard before he passed. And we were very moved, but you know, There was people on the interweb then going, yeah, U2, they killed him. U2 after killing Joey Ramone. I mean, it's, you know, this is it. But it's a love affair with the Ramones. And they were, you know, the greatest group of all time. It's perfect. And those melodies and his singing voice. And the miracle of Joey Ramone
is the voice that he sings in.
It's about finding your voice. And I couldn't sing a lot of things that other people could sing, but I could sing the Ramones. I thought I sounded like a girl, but Joey Ramone, so did he. That was cool.
Okay, well, listen, I'll tell you what, considering the fact that the album you've mentioned, which is the second Ramones album, Ramones Leave Home, because that's where Glad to See You Go is on, is in my top five albums of all time, I'm going to play that, and then I go straight into the song, which is about Joey, which is The Miracle of Joey Ramone, which is the opening track of Songs of Innocence. First of all, the Ramones. There you go, that's music from the Ramones, first of all, which is from the second album from them called Ramones Leave Home, and that's called Glad to See You Go. And just there, you heard The Miracle of Joey Ramone, opening track on Songs of Innocence, and that's from U2. Tell us about This Is Where You Can't Reach Me Now, which is the song about, Joe Strummer, really, and the power of The Clash.
The four members of the band again went to this gig. These were seismic events.
I'm going to fight this one because I went to that gig too, and Ian Wilson put the gig on.
He did.
And I thought they were shite in Trinity.
Oh,
I thought they were great 2 years later in the Top Hatches up the road.
It wasn't a musical experience.
Oh,
per
that's
se.
True. That's true.
It was something else. It was some
visceral,
sort of
in your face,
seismic event. It was the way they looked. I didn't even know what they were on about. I just knew they were on about something serious. And I knew that's the way we could put our sense of rage. Because, you know, we were talking about, you know, grief. But after grief comes rage. Volcano. Volcano follows Iris on the album. And that's a lot to do with that rage. Where do we put that rage? You put that rage into being in a band, into rock and roll. I don't know who said it, rock and roll is a sound of revenge. But that's where it comes from. Then you go and see The Clash and you see rage. And even if you don't know what they're all on about, they're protesting against what, you just see this public service announcement with guitars and you're going, that might give you two. That's where we could put all this idealism, all this asceticism we were learning at the time. Wow, that looks like a revolution we want to be a part of. And they keep saying from the stage, this is yours, you own this, it's not us. And we're going, oh yeah, okay. So after the Clash gig, we just kind of moved address. And that is, we went home, we slept in the same beds, but not really. We had moved address, sort of spiritually, so to speak. We would never be the same again. And Joe Strummer, you know, I got to know him. I wrote his last song with him, a song about Nelson Mandela. And we got to know each other. I'm not even sure, you know, The Clash, it must have been hard for The Clash to see you two. I would never walk on after The Clash. Lots of my favorite bands I would feel like, you know, touch the hem sort of thing, but I wouldn't walk on after The Clash. They were incredible. When they were at full force, there was nothing like them. But back in 1977, this was a militancy that contrasted with all the shite that was going on in Ireland and all the sort of, you know, all the kind of terrorism and whatever it is. Here, this was indoor terrorism, and here was this other kind of soldier, you know, and complete surrender, the only weapon we know. That was our bit we brought to it.
Okay, well, soldier it is. This is where you can't reach me now. This is where you can reach me now. This is the Joe Strummer song, if you like, from U2. Now, Bono, let's take a look at another track then. I might as well go down there. Iris. Iris is about your mother. It's not the first time you've sung about your mother, but there's something genuinely heartbreaking about this one here. I mean, you have some before, even Lemon.
Well, yeah, I mentioned her briefly in Lemon on Zooropa, and I wrote about her unconsciously on our second album,
October,
called
yeah.
Tomorrow, but yeah, I didn't know I was writing song, about her at yeah. the time. This time I was conscious, and look, you know... they say in rock and roll, it's all about the abandonment of the mother. And if you ask Jim Sheeran, he'd say it's all about the mother, abandonment of the mother. But hip hop, it's about the abandonment of the father. They're different. And if you look at John Lydon, you know, or John Lennon, you look at, there's so many rock and rollers who've had this abandonment thing.
Yeah.
And so I had to go there. And I had to realize that this was a big deal. And I realized also that at the time when my mother left me, just as I was discovering girls, one of the girls I was discovering was Ali. I didn't date her for a couple of years, but she arrived in Mount Temple the same month. So I've kind of played with that. And I gave Ali her first gift Lover's Gift was a Kraftwerk album called Man Machine. So I've referred to that.
You have indeed, and a line in the song, yeah.
But it's this idea, you know, that sometimes the things that are the most powerful influence over you, you know, they're from way back. Like you're looking at the night sky and those beautiful stars, a lot of them are gone, but you're still in their light. So the star that gives us light has been gone a while, is the open, but it's not an illusion. The ache that's in my heart, so much a part of who I am. And that's it, you know, this is part of the definition of who I am now. Why should anyone be interested? Well, I don't write for everyone first. I write for myself first to unlock something, an honesty, a truthfulness. And I hope, I can only hope that that will connect with somebody else. But I don't know. And Iris, you know, has made me cringe. It's a beautiful Baroque melody at the end where I've put all these memories of my mother burying me in the sand in Rush as a kid. And my mother saying to me, "You'll be the death of me." And of course, most people outside of Ireland don't understand that. She said, you will be the death of her. I said, it's kind of a way people talk in Ireland. You'll be the death of me. And then you said, but you weren't. And I was like, no. You gotta understand this. This is like how a kid thinks and how a kid talks. Yeah. And there's, you know, so it couldn't be more personal. And the idea that it went out the same day, 40 days after she left us, is kind of magic, I think. And it, of course, as much pull as we have with Apple, we don't have that much pull that we could change Macworld to that anniversary 40 years later. So there you go.
Oh, it's a perfect introduction. Now, I will play the Ali song later, a song for someone, but here's the one about your mother, and this is called Iris. Thank you very much indeed, Jackie. Right, we're back with this interview. We're going to go on now until 11 o'clock with Bono, with the new album and all the rest of it. You see, they're all coming in now from around the world. There's Ellie in Germany. Anyway, 51552 is our text, and at Dave Fanning Show is the Twitter address. Let's get back into it and take a look at the Songs of Innocence album and talk to Bono. It's now 2.5 minutes past the hour of 11.
Text 51552.
Dave Fanning.
On 2FM.
By the way, Bono, Songs of Innocence, if we go to William Blake or whatever, we could go to Songs of Innocence and Experience. And does that mean that you've had, like, it's 5 years since No Line on the Horizon and more. Do you have so many songs stacked up that this is a plan to bring out more in a pretty short space of time? Possibly, maybe not. And therefore we might get Songs of Experience sometime soon?
I think Songs of Experience will be will come a lot quicker. But to explain the wait, we discovered during this process that the level of the songs that we wanted, the ones that we could hear in our head, were different. Was different from what we were able to achieve easily, and that we could get to, you know, some unique musical landscapes, melodies, lyrics. But songs, eternal songs, the ones that last a lifetime, the ones that people hold on to, you know, when they're leaving home, or, you know, when they're building a home, or when they're leaving their job or whatever, these songs, these are rare. They're like miracles. They're almost impossible. And we became great students of the great songwriters. And that's what it was. We wanted to keep pushing up the level. We wanted songs that when you played an acoustic, you could play them on an acoustic guitar or a piano and they stand up. That's not true of every U2 album. It doesn't have to be true of every U2 album, but it is true of this. And it's a fantastic feeling. You know, I'm often in the room and people will say, I don't know, Damon Rice or whatever, pass me the guitar, play one of your songs. And yeah. I won't play a U2 song. I play songs I've written for Roy Orbison or Willie Nelson or something. I never play a U2 song. But these you can play. If you hear every breaking wave on a piano, you just fall over. If it doesn't move you, you're deaf or dead. Or should be.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Every Breaking Wave, and you've mentioned plenty of songs in the album. Some people are not moved by this album at all. I mean, every single album that's ever been released by U2 has got really good reviews or not so great reviews. Everything album released by everybody. I saw reviews there of Grace by Jeff Buckley the other day. The guy can't sing. He ruins Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. It's fantastic. Like, if you look at 20 reviews of Nevermind by Nirvana, you should see some of the reviews. This crowd, we're doing pretty well by the Bleach album, but really, this is a load of rubbish. And it happens all the time.
Joshua Tree. Yeah. Achtung Baby.
Yeah, well, Achtung Baby, I remember there was something in NME and it said something along the lines of, there's no singles here, there's no good songs here, and they really haven't done it. We thought they'd be better in the 1990s, all this kind of stuff, and we all know now. But at the same time, people are giving out about this, saying that this is U2 doing U2. It's doing what they do, as opposed to doing what they might have done before when they reinvented with Achtung Baby by amalgamating all that stuff that was there in terms of, you know, the acid house and the club pop and the dance and all that kind of stuff, or the Manchester scene and that, and bringing it in and using everything, making it look as though it was their own, you know, infusing it with what was their own and making a whole new thing. And like,
do you know what that
they're
is?
Not doing enough of that in some ways. See, well, hold on, I'm going to give you an example before you can go any further, because even the production, if we think about the producers from the past, Eno, Lanois, Lily White, etc., and now you've got Danger Mouse and Paul Epworth and all the rest, regardless of how good they might be safely just doing a U2 here. Now, I'm going to give you just two quick examples. Okay, the first one here, just for about 25 seconds. Here's the opening to Zoo Station in Zaropa. I'm going to give you another one now, which is from the same album. And this is one of my favourite U2 songs of all time. This is the song that gives Overproduction a really good name, because it's just the kitchen sink in here. And on headphones, it's just what's going on, and it just works so well. This is The Fly. Okay, there you go. That's a bit of Zoo Station. That's a bit of The Fly. I'm not getting that from the new album necessarily. I'm not getting some really, like, oh my God, what was that that hit me there? But, like, you know, I'm getting, like, very U2. It's fine, no problem. But it's not necessarily something that I thought you might do after a bunch of years. And I don't even know what it is that you might be amalgamating. Am I looking for you to amalgamate the XX or Bon Iver? I've no idea.
Well, they, you know,
that was a long one. Was there a question there?
Lots of people have amalgamated us, and that might be a problem. Is that some of these things, that some of these textures, mostly that come out of guitar, of the guitar world and out of Edge's palette, and the idea that he can't play those because all the other people have taken those tones from him is preposterous, as he reminds us. But also, lots of reviewers are pointing out just how different this is. And where have we ever heard U2 sound like something like The Troubles, something like This Is Where You Can Reach Me Now, something like Raised by Wolves? Like, what are they talking about? You know, these people are probably talking about Iris. Probably the only song I can think of that sounds like U2 of old. But that's enough. We've got them. We've got one song, so let's go. Why is it not like Zoo Station? Why is it not like Zooropa? It is not an experimental album. It's an album of songs. That's what we want. We do what we want. Our last album was full of experimentation. This is a different kind of experimentation, and might I add, much more difficult thing to pull off. Ask yourself this in evolutionary terms. What is the most difficult thing for anyone to do? It is as easy for me to blow your mind sonically. That's what we do. That's what we do for when we wake up for breakfast is play with the desk and set off, you know, fireworks sonically. U2 can do that all day. We did it in the 90s, we did it on our last album a bit, we'll do it on the next album even more. But this is about songs. They are very, very difficult. Mm. Who can write songs like this? I want to know that. I want to meet the person who can write songs as good as this. Guess what? I probably know them. There's probably only four people. And, you know, so the production is not what we were about here. We were about getting out of the way of the songs.
All right, no, good point. I get that now. Let's go back to that one, the song for someone, right? This is a love song.
The album's about first journeys.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these first journeys are things that you never forget. And your first time to London was invisible. That'll be on the physical package in some which way. California is about
first time
going to
LA
Los Angeles and California and all of that. Song for Someone is about the awkwardness of falling in love, sex, romance. So, you know, I went there. Why didn't I? I mean, people think, you know, sex is supposed to be, you know, like falling off a rolling down a hill. But sometimes it can be very awkward and it contains a lot of emotions for people. That's what I put out there.
Okay, well, let's hear that. This is Song for Someone. Song for Someone is the name of the song. We're talking here Songs of Innocence. That's the album from U2. And Bono, just a few other ones, just about certain ones of the songs here. They're really get a picture home of the whole thing. You mentioned earlier on The Troubles, which is the last song on the album.
Right.
Now, this is a bit more of... This is kind of like a relationship thing here in one way, and it's also a wider thing here. And you get Licky Lee in to help on that.
It's just the old, you know, no comfortable song about domestic violence. And it has this incredible siren who's joined us to sing it, yeah. Licky Lee. She's an amazing girl. She puts us all in a spell with her music, and that spell is on this. We needed a feminine spirit. She was the right one.
Okay, well, let's hear it then. This is the final track on the album. The Troubles is what it's called, and that's from the Songs of Innocence album, and that is from you too. New stuff with Apple that you're thinking of doing. There's something about a new digital musical format. I'm not too sure if you're allowed to mention too much about this yet, but is there some kind of a new thing whereby it's going to really possibly even bring back the idea of buying albums and singles?
Yeah, there's been some real misunderstanding of this relationship with Apple. Some deliberate misunderstanding by just idiots. This is a company who has, more than any other technology company, sought to get musicians paid. Okay, there's lots of other technology companies that become very rich on musicians not getting paid. Mm. So it is a perfect relationship to work with them. They have at the heart of their company some of the most creative people in the world. Johnny Ive, who makes those beautiful machines, and now others like Mark Newson who've joined, and Jimmy Iovine and music, and you know, this is an interesting company. So they were exactly the right people for us to collaborate with, but they know that the period of people paying for MP3 files is waning, and they know that subscription and streaming is coming. This is just like the tide, you know, things just turn. And, you know, I always thought, I was prepared, and I am prepared to pay $1 for an MP3 file. But to really break this open, why can't we see what we're looking at? Why can't we dip into artwork like we used to do before with a gatefold sleeve? Why can't I use with my phone, with my iPad, or my flat screen TV, why can't I disappear into a world created by artists with photography? If we want to listen to Miles Davis in a silent way, why can't we have the photographs of Herman Leonard playing in the background while we do it? Or then with another click, find out what mood he was in when he made that. Or with lyrics, Bob Dylan's lyrics, why can't we read his lyrics while we're listening to his music at a certain point in time? So 5 years ago, I began a conversation with Steve Jobs in our house in France. And I said to Steve, how is it for a person who cares about the way things look and feel more than anyone else in the world that iTunes looks like a spreadsheet? He was not happy. But that was before they'd even managed to get a full screen photograph up.
Yeah.
So he made a promise to me that we would work on this together. And with the team at Apple, we've been doing it for years. And it's not ready yet for Songs of Innocence. It will be ready for Songs of Experience. And it's very, very exciting. It's a new format. And you can still get the MP3 file. You can rob it or whatever you want, but you won't be having the full experience. It'd be like you walking down the street in Dublin in the 70s with a copy of the Rolling Stones Sticky Fingers, just the vinyl, and not the Andy Warhol design sleeve. You wouldn't feel like you had the proper package.
True.
I'm excited about that. Second question about Apple. So they don't just have 500 million iTunes accounts. They have 885 million iTunes accounts. And we are going to help them and want to help them get that number to 1 billion. That is 1/7 of the Earth's population. Ask yourself the question, if 1/10 of those people were to be part of a subscription service like Spotify has, and I'm a huge Spotify fan, so that's $10 a month. Do the math. That's $1 billion a month. That's $12 billion. That's bigger than the entire music business coming out of one company if 1/10 of those people became. So even if it was 5%, so now musicians suddenly are in a game that people are ready to pay for. Their lives are changed. And forget touring bands. It's what about songwriters? Cole Porter, where would he be now? He didn't sell T-shirts. So my mate Simon Carmody is an amazing songwriter. He's not a performer in a band right now, but he writes songs. I want to see him get paid. So this thing that you choose for free music is a load of bollocks, or people who are too blind to read the newspaper properly.
Okay, well then, songwriters who are not necessarily touring people, and new artists discover on Spotify, say, don't get paid. They will now
get... Oh, no, they will get paid. Even on Spotify, they will get paid. Spotify...
If Spotify uses this as well.
If Spotify gets to scale, and they are using this model, the problem is with Spotify...
It's very hard to pull people away from Spotify.
I don't think... Spotify's incredible. Yeah. And I'm an utter believer in Spotify, because they have 10 or 15% of the people who get it free convert to get the premium service. That they will next year... I think they'll contribute $1 billion to the music business. Now, will all those artists who've been played find out they were played? At this moment, it's a bit too opaque for me. It's not transparent enough. So I went into Universal and I said, listen, this better change. People need to know, and the technology is available for them to know, when they were being played and how many times they've been played, and therefore when they could be paid. And a really great guy in Universal Europe called David Joseph. He said, Bono, we're working on this. Again, we're 18 months away. We know this wave of transparency is breaking. That is mind-blowing. Can you imagine? Let's say, pick an artist, a local artist, and they will find out where they were played on a digital service and in what geography, what town, so they can book tours if suddenly it's broken in Sweden or something. It's so exciting. I'm very, very optimistic.
And are we talking high-res studio master downloads on iTunes?
Is that like, yes.
Right. Okay, that's that point, and that's for the future. Let's get back to the songs on the album.
Thank you.
And this one here. If in 1974, your mother dies, brain aneurysm, and you have the song called Iris. But also in 1974, the bombs in Dublin happened. One of the strongest songs in the album, and this is a real kind of powerful song, is the one about that. It is a story whereby you take a bicycle to school, and if you hadn't taken a bicycle to school, you could well have been in Talbot Street on that day in a record shop. It is a story where a friend of yours was there, saw what happened. You've written about him in the song Bad, because his life turned very sour after that, and now it's turned... He's okay now.
He survived.
He survived.
And he's dealing with a few issues, hepatitis C being one of them from his days as a junkie. But he's a remarkable man, a very poetic figure, by the way, a great writer. I'm trying to encourage him to write a book. It'll be mind-blowing. Andy Rome, we used to call him Gook Pants Delaney, and Googie's brother, and came out of the same house with the cherry blossom tree there, and he's with his dad, and they're around the corner when the bomb goes off, and he gets, dad locks him in the van, he's banging on the van trying to get out. Eventually he gets out, And the carnage in Dublin, it's hard to... This is the worst day of this troubles. 33 people died. And it was down south in our city. And he, his father, was nobly trying to help the people, and the dismembered bodies everywhere. It was the most disgusting thing for a kid to go through. He was 11 years old. He never quite got over it. I guess you'd call it post-traumatic stress disorder now. And he turns to the most, famous painkiller in the world as a teenager. It was cheap at the time, which was smack. A lot of people were on heroin in Dublin in the 70s. And there's a scene in the second verse where some girls are writing on him with a hypodermic needle, his hypodermic needle, and they have ink and they're tattooing their names on his body. And I've contrasted that with what I said. It's a gruesome sight. But the chorus has defiance. Raised by wolves, we're stronger than fear. If I open my eyes, you disappear. He has courage, he has metal. Funny enough, metal. When I called him only a few weeks ago to ask his permission to say his name, he said, no, I'm fine with you telling my story. I'm fine with that. And then he said, give me a second. He put down the phone and he went over and he said, you'll never guess what I'm carrying in my hand. I said, "What's that, Andy?" He says, "It's a piece of the car." I said, "What?" He says, "Yeah, I've taken it with me everywhere. The car that tried to kill them." Yeah, I mean, by the way, this would be forensic evidence. in any other, if it was 10 years ago, probably even. And I was wondering why he had taken it with him, but I guess it had taken a little bit of him. So he had taken a little bit of him. And he's moved, you know, he's lived all over the world, but taken this piece of metal. So it's still a raw wound, clearly, for him. And it must be one for me, because I'm always wondering, why do I write about these things? Why would we have written about Sunday Bloody Sunday? Edge of Myself is around, we're talking about this kind of stuff. But the reason I do is probably rooted in the fact that I might have been one of those statistics on any other Friday night.
Of course.
I was supposed to be in Talbot Street. And like, I'm sure there's a lot of people with these stories. And there was a record shop I used to go to. And, you know, it was a regular thing there. It's just, it was sunny, I think, that day.
No, everybody remembers. Tea time Friday. I was in the canteen in University College Dublin in Belfield. Everybody knows where they were. Let's hear the song then. This is called Raised by Wolves. Raised by Wolves is what it's called.
Now, are you telling me that sounds like anything you two has ever done?
No, okay. You would pick. No, that's not fair. No, hold on a second.
Just say it.
Hold on a second. Okay, okay.
It's like,
okay.
It's, I'm just saying, this is, don't believe this. So people will poison you, they put these viruses, actually ask the question, hold on a second.
I just think where other people come, like, okay, let's put it another way. All these people write them and stuff like that. Do you get a bit fed up with the fact that so little is said about the music sometimes?
Or just the old shite, the cliches. Look, all the smart critics, all the great critics have loved this album and seen through it. But some people put it on and go, "Yeah, I think I heard that before." But I'm, these are people who are...
If you're going to be as successful as long as you're going to be, people just want to knock that down. You're prepared for that. That's okay, isn't it?
Yeah, I kind of take it as a compliment. I mean, we were always the band to divide people, not to unite people. That's it. You know, it was to sing In the Name of Love, What More in the Name of Love. It was as uncool in 1984 as it is now. And that's why people came through the doors, because someone was going to say it. To sing about your faith, how uncool is that in rock and roll? Sing about your mother.
Yeah.
Come on. It's like, shut up. Except John Lennon did it. You know, Kurt Cobain did it. Eminem has done it. You know, what is the point in being in U2 if you can't go to those other places? And what are we up against? Some sort of hip non sequiturs. Few sort of interesting couplets strung together on a good groove. People can assemble in GarageBand on Apple, and it's kind of cool atmospheres. That's not where we're playing anymore. We're not interested in that playground. And let me tell you, that it feels exactly the same as we did when I was honest enough, and we were honest enough to say to you, we don't just want to be in the clubs.
Yeah.
We want to play over there. And I remember at the time that was like breaking the law. It was like impossible. Then you mustn't be a real punk band. We said, no, we're not a real punk band. Do we sound like a real punk band? No. So now we're saying it's not enough to just be him or be in U2 and do other things. We're going with songs.
Yeah.
And we're going to write great, great, great songs. And of course, you have to be a great, great, great songwriter maybe to understand if they are or not, and not some cloth-eared critic.
But you always said in those early days in the radio in the late 70s when we were doing Pirates and all the rest, you always said that success is not kind of some kind of a bitter word or something. So why is it that if the Beatles and the Stones and Zeppelin, they never had to apologise for being big?
No, but you know, you forget how bitter it was with the Beatles. I mean, John Lennon...
Zeppelin were vilified.
John Lennon was you know, because the Rolling Stones were the hip band at the time, and he was writing, you know, Mick was writing Street Fighting Man to John Lennon writing All You Need Is Love. And they were, you know, Beatles writing Let It Be, and the Stones would be like, yeah, Let It Bleed. I mean, there was all these games going on, and the Beatles always felt like a pop band. And because the British blues explosion was happening, and that was what was cool.
Yeah.
And they were into songs. So this has gone on since time immemorial. Then it reverses, and we discover songs again, and suddenly Led Zeppelin are, you know, vilified. And then I remember, you know, one of the greatest atmospheric albums of all time, masterpiece, Roxy Music's Avalon, was just shredded by not an asshole, but one of my favorite critics, one of the guys who opened up Joy Division to me, Paul Morley, he didn't like it at the time. So that's just the way it goes around, you know. It's like, I think we have to be big boys and accept it.
Okay, but like just one thing about the Beatles and the Stones there in the late 60s in terms of just what they were both doing. If the Stones were supposedly documenting the times in terms of a lot of civil unrest around the world, and not just Vietnam and the Sorbonne and everything else, if the Stones were kind of, you know, telling it like it was, street fighting man, etc., and the Beatles, as you say, were saying all you need is love, John tried to rectify that when he went solo, and I think he made a fool of himself. He let every stupid political moron from Malcolm X and whatever, you know, kind of get inside his head. And he kind of brought out A, bad music, and he didn't know what he was doing or which protest he was going to.
Except he also did some of the most unrelenting introspection of any of us.
Listen, don't get me wrong. That first solo album called John Lennon Plastic Ono Band is still one of the all-time greatest albums ever. And the Imagine album is great. After that,
that's where we were going. Yeah. That's where we were going.
Yeah.
No, The Who actually is another one. Like Quadrophenia, that was another template for us. It's like, you know, Pete Townsend was trying to understand where he came from, and you know, that was it.
Would it be fair to say then, before I play the next song, finally, that, you know, success, fame, and all the rest of it, that has never been allowed get in the way of what I would call the band dynamic of you two? Success and fame are just offshoots. They are just whatever. Like, this is what we do, and we do it because we want to. For instance, this time around, we are releasing an album of songs.
Yeah, but we must be clearly, we're very ambitious for those songs. You know, people say your songs are like your children. No, they're not. They're like your parents. They tell you what to do, and they tell you what clothes to wear. They tell you what you've got to do and what time you have to be home at. The job of any songwriter is to protect the songs. What was always different about U2, and this is something Paul McGuinness really instilled with us at a very early age, if you care about your work, any artist who cares about his work wants to know where that work is going to be hung, who that gallerist is going to be. Get to know that stuff, because if you don't know that stuff, that will crush you. That's crushed so many bands. You know what's crushed so many bands? Money. So why don't you share amongst each other? Don't go into, well, I wrote that song and you wrote that bit. So we never played that game. And what we have done is tried to understand the apparatus of our success or failure. Marx who said, you know, seize the means of production. So it might be odd for you to sit here and hear me talking about writing these, the most bare-bones songs we've ever written, next to giving you the numbers on on Apple iTunes accounts and their conversion to subscription in a best case scenario. But I've learned that. And Paul McGuinness, I was 18 and I nodded as if I knew what he was talking about. He turned to me in some club of banging music and he quoted F. Scott Fitzgerald. He says, I want to work with you. I want to work with you. Because you understand the whole equation. And I was like, yeah, I'm good. Like, I had no idea what he meant, but I know now. I know what it takes to get a band through the different struggles, to get myself through struggles, to hold on to family, to hold on to friends, to figure it out, to not have its lens distort you, and yet at the same time be able to make your mistakes, do stupid shit. When there's cameras around. So it is a whole equation. What gets you, what has gotten us from there to here is not just the music, it's relationships and understandings and empathy. So it is complex. I'm not trying to answer your question simply, but in the end it's that we might one day get to a place where we could write a song as good as Song for Someone, or Every Breaking Wave, or Raised by Wolves.
Okay, well, before I play Every Breaking Wave, then, as a final song, you mentioned money there. And if you look at the way, like it's done this before, in terms of giving away free downloads, Daft Punk have done it, Feist, Black Eyed Peas, The Ting Tings, Jet, you mentioned Jay-Z and Samsung, Beyonce is known as well. Is the one thing that seems to rankle, and just like, is the fact that you gave the album to somebody and they paid for it to you.
Oh, we didn't give it.
You sold
Apple
it.
Gave it.
Yeah.
We sold it to Apple for a month.
Yeah, exactly, for the month. And they're the ones that are doing the download.
Yeah, it's their generosity, yeah. Not ours.
And then the album will come out in October as well.
Yeah.
And not only that, you have now reached more people than you could ever possibly have reached in any other single way. So if you think of the way you've always broken down barriers, go right back to, say, I don't know, pick one out of the ether, Under a Blood Red Sky, in other words, the Red Rocks gig, MTV. That was a big moment.
That was the technology of its day.
That's what I'm saying.
But always, you know, the relationship with music and technology is very, very deep. It goes back to, you know, overriding transistors with a signal that is coming from an electric guitar. That's, you know, the change of vocal styles that came from singing like Pavarotti to being able to croon like Frank Sinatra to be able to then sing over a loud guitar, bass and drums that was rock and roll, that converted to samplers and drum machines and keyboards that created dance music and trance music. We always ride the technology. That's the fun of it. And the distribution systems will also change. Because, for instance, if you play in a car, that, you know, that awful, well, it's not all awful, but that sort of 70s rock that was so huge in America at the time, we thought it was the enemy. It sounded great in cars in America because that was it. Hip hop sounds amazing with subwoofers. So it's always the technology dictates the sound way more than any artist is willing to admit. The distribution system's important. We found one that we could ride. We found a wave we could ride with this album.
Okay, and then therefore there's a whole new world out there in terms of selling your record. That's the one that you've tapped into now. And there will be a whole new world by the looks of things with this new thing you were talking about earlier on with Apple.
Yep.
Okay, well, listen, Bono, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And onwards and upwards, and may the road rise with you, agus gan Éirí an Bohorlath.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks, dude.
Good man yourself, Bono. Fair play to you.
I think we went there.
I think we went there too, and we'll go there with this and all the rest, yeah.
It's my first proper interview.
So, is it?
Yeah.
All right, pretty good.